as a meditating, influential peace movement kind of worker over in the Middle East and so on. So we want to talk to her about all she does. So I'm excited. And the first thing I like to do is we're going to do a structure, a meditational structure, and then we'll come back to Susan. So I'm going to ask all of you listening to close your eyes unless you're driving. And we're going to call in. Take a deep breath. And we're creating a vibrational structure in which you can enhance your own role in your life and your meditations and your manifestations. So many of you are familiar with this. See above your head, perhaps a mile and a half, a golden ball. And see below your spine, perhaps 20 feet, another golden ball. And draw a filament of light from the upper ball through your spine into the lower ball. You should be able to feel the radiance of that. I shouldn't say should. Many of you will feel the radiance of this filament of light as it runs through your body. Now around your waist at an 8-foot radius from your body, see a series of golden balls. So that you have a great circle of golden balls around your waist, 8 feet from your body. And then from the upper golden ball to the series of golden balls, drop many, many filaments of pink light. So you have a little pink canopy pointing upwardly. And now drop the same kind of filaments of pink light from the golden balls to the lower ball. And now you're in a tent-like structure, pointing upwardly and pointing down. And inside of our structure, an etheric crystal ball. Now remember, the crystal ball is a very feminine energy. You may feel a shift in your own energy field as you're in this crystal ball. And inside of that, you'll be in the double tetrahedron. That's a three-sided pyramid pointing up and a three-sided pyramid pointing down. So it ultimately looks like a diamond shape, or a lot like a diamond. And inside of that double tetrahedron, see yourself spinning and spinning and spinning. And spin and spin, and you can feel the spinning run through your body as well. This is a great way to clear up conflicting energies or denser frequencies. And whilst you're spinning, see a magical screen in front of you. And on that screen, take a minute and place a couple of little movies of what it is you'd like to manifest. Whether it's deep, personal, inner, or external. We're just going to do this for a few minutes. It can be how you're feeling. It can be for someone else. Now draw yourself back into your double tetrahedron. Is it still spinning? And give it a quick spin. Brighten up your field. And now we're coming back into our visit with Susan Bradbury, acupuncturist and world traveler, somebody who's making a difference on the globe, matching the Fire of the Grid activity. How many of you watched or did the Fire of the Grid? We'll hear about that later. And now, Susan, you just got back from Africa, didn't you?
Yes.
And who sent you there?
I sent myself there.
Great. Wonderful.
How it all happened is I listened to a fellow named Prosper, who is a Burundian man, give a speech in Seattle, and we're both ambassadors for peace with the United Nations.
Oh, my.
And his speech just ignited a fire in me, and I just felt like I have to go. I have to do something to help these women that have gone through the genocide in the mid-90s.
Hmm.
Most people have not heard about Burundi, and they have not heard that Burundi also went through a genocide similar to Rwanda.
Hmm.
It was an ethnic war with the Hutus and the Tutsis. And so they have come to a beautiful place now where they're not speaking about their ethnicity, but they're speaking about themselves being Burundians and rebuilding their country.
How many of the people were killed? Was it like a huge percentage?
500,000.
Oh, my goodness.
Out of 8 million people,
wow.
Population. So it's quite significant. It left about 300,000 women, men, and children in refugee camps.
Oh, my.
And 60% of the homes, schools, and hospitals were destroyed. And so there's these amazing women that are widows that are trying to make a life for themselves and are in extreme poverty.
Right.
Their strength and beauty and endurance and courage just takes your breath away. And so the little bit that we could do to help each woman that we were able to meet with has already, I just spoke with Brundi today, has already made a difference. So the women are starting to say, I can put my children to sleep at night without them crying from hunger. So microlending is really another form of women's empowerment.
So when you go to Burundi, who do you actually talk to?
When I went to Burundi, I went to a village called Chirama. And in Chirama, we met about 70 women, and we spoke with those women. We didn't...
They knew you were coming from, like, the UN or from your own project?
They knew. Mm-hmm. And they sang to us as we came in, which just vibrated every cell.
Mm.
It was incredible. And we spoke to them about some of the qualities needed to be a person that's selected for microlending, such as trustworthiness and being responsible and being honest. And then also collaborating and working as a group and supporting each other, knowing the first wave of women that got the microlending loans are paving the way for everyone else.
Oh.
And then we went to a village called Chipitoki. And Chipitoki was an interesting journey as we had to travel about 52 kilometers from Bujumbura, the capital of Burundi. And we had to go through about 10 rebel groups and just pray that each rebel group would allow us to go through so that we could get to these women.
Mm-hmm.
And we met 84 women singing again,
wow,
courageous and beautiful. And those women, they have to spend 4 or 5 hours a day collecting water, walking to the water, filling their cans, walking back home. And the water not only is a long distance, but it's not filtered, so it's quite dirty.
Mm.
And many diseases become of that. And what these women have come up with is so innovative. They're selling bananas, they're making baskets, they're selling charcoal because it's very hard to find wood to cook with. They're taking large cans of cooking oil and selling smaller amounts.
Mm.
They're even selling lemonade.
Wow.
So it's just amazing to watch what a little bit of help, how much that can make a difference in a village.
When you said a little bit of help, you told me earlier that the amount of money that is required to get them in business for themselves is low compared to what we'd expect.
The amount of money to kind of kickstart a whole new life for probably at least 10 people is $50.
Mm-hmm.
So our goal was to go over there and fund at least 100 women to start out with. We also started a farm with 20 Congolese women and 20 Rwandan women that had escaped the genocide and war from their countries into Burundi. They'd found land. They had this dream to grow sweet potatoes and corn and bean and rice at various times of the year. They just needed the money.
Wow.
So we funded them. We bought them machetes and shovels and boots, and the farm's already going.
Wow. Are they really happy about
They're
it, I'll bet it.
Very happy. And then the third thing we did, which involved about 50 women to start with, is we started a beaded bracelet project called Full Circle. And we... Because Burundi does not have any beads, they don't have the supplies at all, we brought suitcases full of beads and laid them out, and women would make the bracelets. We brought them back. We'll sell them in the United States, and it's another way of funding these women for further projects. We'll send the money 100% back to them.
How wonderful. And I bet they trust you. Are you in touch with them fairly often?
I'm in touch with them very often. We hired a Burundian woman to be our manager on the ground.
Mm.
So probably twice a week, we email each other, and so she keeps me up
to speed. She has email?
Yes, she has email in Bujumbura. She's in the capital, and then she goes out to these villages.
Hmm.
We needed somebody that was fairly educated, that could track the money and also write reports for us and track the women. So she goes out to the various villages and checks on the women.
How interesting. What is it like when you go there? How do you feel? Is it overwhelming?
When you go there, it's quite a bit overwhelming. It's really hot, really humid, really dusty. There's thousands of people on the road. And it's also incredibly colorful. And when you go to some of these villages, it does take your breath away because you realize there's no water, there's very little food. Many people don't even have homes. And so it's a very different
life. This itself isn't a refugee camp that you're in, it's the actual...
We were in refugee camps, and then it's also the actual place where these people live. So the poverty is extreme, and my dream is to bring them up to poverty and then keep going.
And see if you can help them generate what it is.
And become really sustainable. We're looking at water systems, we're looking at more farms, and possibly some goats, which would be helpful for them.
So how many projects have you funded there in that area?
In that area, we started out with 50 women with the micro-lending projects, 20 women with the farm, and 50 women with the bracelets. And we're ready to fund another 50 women. We want to just do this in steps so that Justine, the woman on the ground, gets a real handle of what the women that have started are in the phase one, we'll call it. They seem to be going well. They've done it for 6 weeks, and so we're ready to fund phase two, which will be about another 20 women. And then we'll just continue on from there. And
it's only been 6 weeks so far?
It's only been 6 weeks.
Wow, how exciting.
It's very exciting.
Wow, this is wonderful. And this is your idea?
This is my idea.
Great, good for you. How wonderful. Susan is also a pretty amazing sound healer along with her acupuncture. So I suppose the music itself is really touching for you. It always would be anyway.
The music is very touching because it's got such a resonance. It feels like it's very healing. In this place that has a lot of deconstruction, it's a way to kind of construct the whole life back together again.
Wonderful, wonderful. Now, that's not the only place that you're doing micro-lending.
No.
Talk about Mongolia.
Okay, Mongolia is very dear to my heart. I started a project there in 2005, and it all started in Seoul, South Korea, when I took a hike in the mountains by myself and hiked all day with a Mongolian woman and a Korean woman. And we had three very different languages, so we only spoke from the heart. And after that day, I just came home and knew I had to start a project in Mongolia.
Wow.
Came to Bellingham, where I live, and the following week met Venerable Ultral Rinpoche, who happened to be visiting in the Lummi Island area.
Really interesting.
And he works in Mongolia, and the Dalai Lama had asked him to be there. So we developed a relationship, and from there I met a Mongolian woman that lives in Bellingham, and we decided that we really needed to help some of the young women go to college in their own country and also bring medical supplies. We're also planting trees there because there's a lot of deforestation, and planting blueberry bushes at orphanages.
Oh.
Because they need the vitamins. There's very little fruit. And the micro-lending has been completely different than Africa in Mongolia. Quite exciting. We started bakeries. And
What bakeries?
And the bakeries are in the women's homes, and their homes are, Mongolia was communist until 1990. So their homes that we're working with is a city called Erdenet. They're the old Russian apartments, and not everybody has an oven. So a woman that has an oven, she's able to have three or four other women join her, and they make bread dough, they make cookies, they make pastries, and then they sell them at the little kiosk that's around the apartment buildings there. And to date, we just funded a couple of, two more bakeries, so now we have five bakeries going.
Wonderful.
Which, in essence, each person, it touches at least 10 people.
Isn't that something? Oh, my. And are you going to continue going there? What else are you
doing
in Mongolia?
I'm leaving for Mongolia August 9th, and I'll be there till September 2nd. The other thing that I do in Mongolia is film the storytellers in the countryside. The first year, the summer of 2005, I spent a month with the reindeer people, and they actually live with reindeer, ride reindeer, milk the reindeer, make reindeer cheese.
Wow.
And they live in teepees up at Lake Huskel, which is the northern part of Mongolia. Last summer, I spent a month in Arhangai, which is more southern. It's not the Gobi Desert, but it's before the Gobi Desert. And that's a people that's very herders. There's lots of sheep and goats and yaks and horses. And in fact, I was given a horse last summer.
Great.
As a sign of honor. For the work that we're doing. And this summer, I'm really excited about this. We're actually going to go up to Bayan-Olgi, which is close to Kazakhstan, so there's quite a Muslim influence, and there's a lot more camels in that area. The embroidery is quite different, and what I'm specifically looking for is the eagle hunters. That they're the eagle people, and they actually train eagles to ride on their arms, on horses. There's only 40 left in the whole world. And so I'm going to be meeting with them and with throat singers. We'll be meditating with the eagles and saying prayers of peace and then just living with the people for several weeks.
Well, Sunna, tell me how you actually meet the people that you want to meet. You're going to meet with the eagle people. You'll attract them. You resonate.
It's completely by spirit. We just leave every one of these trips I've told you about with the ranger people and the herders and now the eagle people. We leave with the intention that we're able to find the storytellers that we want to film and capture their stories that may be lost someday. And we go with several Mongolians. So there's more Mongolians than Americans.
And how many Americans are there?
Well, last year we had 7 Mongolians to 3 Americans. Myself, a filmmaker, and another fellow. And we just start driving. And you go into this vast land, and you see these little white bumps, which are gares, which most people know as yurts. But yurt's a Russian word, and ger is a Mongolian word. And the tradition in Mongolia is much different than the United States. If you run across a ger, you're welcome to walk right through the door, right into the middle of the family.
Oh, my.
And this is just...
That wouldn't go over well here.
That wouldn't go over well here, but it's very acceptable there. And so the Mongolians just lead us right in. The women sit on one side on little stools, and the men on the other. And before any discussion happens, the woman that's the head of the gear brings you a bowl of milk tea. And you drink the milk tea, and you often will have a piece of cheese or a piece of bread, and then you start talking.
And are they reluctant to do storytelling for you who might be from another place? I mean, is there...
There never was any reluctance. It was if they were so blessed that someone was recording these stories. I think their culture is changing so much because when it was communist, the Russians would give so much sugar and so much butter and so much flour and then 2 bottles of vodka. And because these are an indigenous people, the vodka didn't go well with their systems. And so because the alcoholism is quite high in the countryside, it's disrupted the nomadic way of life. And if you lose a mother or father, it's harder for you to move your gear. So what happens is some of these people have ended up in these shanty towns around Ulaanbaatar, which is the capital of Mongolia. And then they don't have their traditional life anymore and oftentimes aren't able to pass on their stories to their children.
So it's kind of the culture has been coming apart.
It's been coming apart. Bit by bit. And so the Mongolians that are part of the Sound Essence Project, Mongolian women, their biggest dream is to preserve these stories for not only to make a documentary, but also to give to Mongolia, as this is some of your heritage and history. And it changes very quickly. Last summer, we met a woman. Most people, their average life expectancy is early 60s. She was very unusual. She was 80. And when we saw her, we thought, you know, we'll be back in a week in this area. We'll film her then. And close to the end of that week, somebody came on horseback to get me to help her because she was dying. And so you start to learn things are very impermanent and we must catch them at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Is it rough living over there, changing the subject a little bit? Is it very hard for you, and is it easier in Mongolia than Burundi?
Well, you know, it's so different because in Mongolia it's so spacious. There's lots of land, big sky. Everywhere you look, it's either green valleys or hundreds of horses.
My.
Now, when we're in Mongolia, we're living in tents. Sometimes if there's terrible rainstorms, then we're invited into the gears. And there is a wood stove in the middle, oftentimes a dirt floor. So it's quite rough living in a sense. But there's a richness because you're so close to nature. In Burundi, I think there's an overwhelming sadness with people that they don't speak about that you can feel. And because of the heat, the extreme heat and humidity, to me it's harder to live in Burundi.
Mm-hmm. And also the fact that there isn't that wealth feeling of being close to nature.
Right.
I mean, at least that's the feeling I get
from
you. How about, I want to take this in several directions, but one is, who do you raise money for this? Can people participate in this?
Yes, we raise money any way we can, by writing grants, by, you know, donations. We're a 501c3, the Sound Essence Project, at www.soundessenceproject.org.
Okay.
And you know, people send us $20, $50, $1,000, and we just, you know, keep working to build up that fund, and then that's where we take it, either to Africa, to Burundi, or to Mongolia.
And you find that people are really responsive when money comes?
People are really responsive. Mongolia is more difficult because most people with Mongolia have a heart for Mongolia.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes people don't realize Mongolia is surrounded by Russia and China, and it's a very important country to remain sovereign. There's been so much more awareness about Africa. Africa's quite easy to raise money for.
Yeah, I don't think I know anything about Mongolia at all.
Yeah.
One of the things I loved talking to you last week or whenever it was you're saying that people don't realize how much impact you can have. Like, what did you say was the average income in Burundi?
The average income in Burundi is $100 to $150 a year.
Wow. Isn't that incredible?
So you give somebody $25 to $50 as a microlending project, it changes their whole life and their family's life.
What's the return, for example, you say micro-lending, so this isn't a donation. This is something that they...
It's not a donation. We've looked at what Eunice did in Bangladesh, and there is a 95 to 98% return on someone's investment. The way we've actually conceptualized it is we're really not looking to make money from this. We're looking to just roll it over into the next woman, for instance.
But also, I just want to say that lending them money is more empowering than
it's
just...
It's more empowering, but the... all of the research and statistics and just life experience show that by lending a woman money and her paying it back, it raises her self-esteem, it raises her family's self-esteem and her sense of responsibility.
And
it's very
empowered.
Yes, yeah. It's very... And we actually see it as a grassroots women's empowerment movement.
Hmm. That's wonderful. I just get really excited about it. But also, it's empowering... at least to me and to other listeners, I hope, to know that we can have a huge impact in a world that seems so horrendously out of balance, you know?
It's amazing. It's, in fact, last summer when we visited the students as an example in Mongolia, the first year we interviewed them along with their parents, which they only had one parent, or a few had no parents, their self-esteem was very low. They were very shy and very nervous about speaking with us. Last year, after their first year of college, not only had their self-esteem risen tremendously, but whatever parent was with them and their siblings, it was really amazing to just see how this changed everything.
The door of potential is sitting right there.
Yeah.
Isn't that exciting?
It just changed everything. And evidently, I haven't seen this yet, but just in 6 weeks, this is happening in Burundi.
Wow. When are you going back to Africa?
Probably in January.
Great.
Yeah, I'm probably going back in January and just keep launching more projects.
That's just wonderful. I feel so inspired when you talk about this. There's another aspect. I don't know if we're going to take callers today. I guess we'll just see if we have any callers and won't worry about it. But there's another aspect of your global work, and I would like to come back to these two countries, but the fact that you go into the Middle East as well and that you work with leaders. Would you like to talk a little bit about who you meditate with?
Yes. In the last 9 months, I've traveled to the Middle East three times, last October, just recently in April, and then just recently about 3 weeks ago. And when I go to the Middle East, I go as a member of Women's Federation for World Peace, and I also go as an ambassador for peace.
Hmm.
And Women's Federation for World Peace is in general consultative status with UNESCO through the United Nations.
Wonderful.
So there's many wonderful connections. We meet with anywhere from 50 to 100 people from all over the world. There's quite a European contingency that meets with us. Many Americans. Recently, there's been several people, even from the White House, that have come.
Mm.
And at the same time, we meet with various religious leaders. From the Muslim faith, from the Christian faith, from the Jewish faith. And we've actually, now that I've gone three times in this last 9 months, we've built many bridges and crossed many paths together and have that common theme of wanting peace in the Middle East. We also go into Palestine. The areas, depending on the violence, usually we are able to go into the West Bank and to Ramallah. We've never been able to cross into Gaza. It seems to be too dangerous right now, but we've also gone into Bethlehem. And we not only go to the sacred sites and bring that energy of sacredness with us, but we also meet with the people and go to lunch at their homes and hear their stories.
So you get both sides of the war pictures.
So we get both sides of things, and it's quite astounding going into Palestine because you do have to go through checkpoints, you do have to go through people with machine guns, and there's lots of razor-sharp barbed wire that surrounds Palestinian territories, and the big walls are being built. And we actually go with the open heart of wanting the best for everyone and wanting peace for everyone. So it has nothing to do with choosing sides or making, you know, assumptions, because it's a very old, complicated problem.
The people that you're meeting that represent, say, the Muslims and the whichever factions, the Jewish people and so on, do you ever have the kinds of discussions that bring up both sides that have some contention, or is it always just peace at,
I think
under those circumstances?
It's really, in those circumstances, it's really peace because they've had so many of their own personal confrontations that they're exhausted from.
Mm-hmm.
And that by bringing people in from outside of the Middle East, what people tell us over and over again, it actually helps infuse new energy.
It's a little like being a crystal, isn't it?
It's a little like being a crystal.
Maybe you want
it's
to
like
talk about
it. It's like bringing your bright light and resonating to a different vibration and bringing that there. And, you know, I still am in very close contact every couple of days with several people from that area, either by email or by phone. And they often say, it gives me hope to hear your voice, to have a connection with the outside world, that somebody cares about us and our situation and how complex it is.
Wonderful. Oh, my. I guess what I'm thinking is it could be pretty exhausting. It could be very tense to go to that place, that area.
It is very exhausting. In fact, this last time I went, it was just days after things had erupted in Gaza. And I found myself doing something I had not done the two times before, is every night I would go to my room, open up the window, listen to the piano music from the bar, and just lay on my bed and meditate and pray. Is I found that because it was, there was so much going on there politically and militarily, it was quite exhausting. And I was meeting with some of the generals and various political leaders, and so I needed to just be able to balance myself every night.
Well, how do you get to meet with the generals? So they must be, some of them must be seeking peace, or?
Some of them are seeking peace, and I had met some of the generals in October in a meeting with the EU, and just kept in touch as another way of building bridges towards peace.
Wonderful. It's mind-boggling. I remember one day you told me that you had given crystals.
Right? Yes.
I like that story.
And what I did, I believe it was in October of 2006, the first time I traveled to the Middle East, I brought two large amethyst crystals, one for a Palestinian and one for an Israeli. The first one that, and I just said, let the person that needs to have this present themselves to me. And I had met one of the retired generals of the Israeli army, and we had gotten into a discussion. I had gone back to his office, and we had spoken about various aspects of peace in the Middle East, and I just knew he was the person to give this to. Then, several days later, I'd had a very deep spiritual experience at the Beatitudes. And after that, had gone to the Jordan River and actually been baptized in the Jordan River.
Wonderful, wow.
And I decided to be baptized as the second amethyst crystal, so that whoever may have this crystal, it would be charged with that river water and with spirit. And the following day, we went to Ramallah, which is the Palestinian territory. And in Ramallah, I was able to meet with the number two person under President Abbas. And when I gave him this crystal, he started crying. And he pointed to the bottom of it, the base of it, and he said, "This is where Israel and Palestine is." And then he pointed to the very top point of this amethyst crystal and said, "This is where we need to get to. We need to get to God."
Oh, wonderful. Oh, my. Wow, so you really are in touch with the global tensions in a way, aren't you?
Yes.
You're right up against the flame. How exciting. So I'm jumping around in a way, but I want to know something about the spiritual essence of the people in Burundi. What is their take on spirituality and philosophy and coping?
Well, what was really fascinating is we were invited to go to an evangelical Central African church service.
Oh, my. Evangelical. Okay.
Evangelical with 500 people. And I was to speak, which I did speak at that church. And everybody has a lot of spirit. There's a lot of singing. It's a three-hour service. There's lots of hallelujahs, and I ended up saying many hallelujahs myself. And I saw for the first time, being with the people there, how important that religion is to them. It's a way of bringing them together. It's a way of having a common bond and having a sense of hope.
And great expression.
And so much expression with all the music and the singing and the dancing and the swaying. And there was about five different preachers and five different choirs that sang. And so that was my experience in Burundi of one part of spirituality. Now, we also met with a few medicine people that wasn't necessarily their way.
Mm-hmm.
Their way was more, it almost felt somewhat shamanic, I would say. But that was just a few people that we met with.
Hmm.
You know, I think
Are they accepted and revered, honored, and used quite well?
I think so. I think so, but I think at the same time there is also a sense of being slightly quiet about their ways.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
There's a judgment there.
Yeah, that there's some judgment is what my perception was.
But you're not sure about that. You also told me a story about meeting a woman who had her leg taken off and shot off.
This wasn't it. We had already been to Chirama, the first village, and we'd been to Chipitoki, which is the village that we had to go through the Pin Rebel group. So the following day, every day was about 12 hours long. Hmm. The following day, we were in a place called Kenyosa, which was just outside of Bujumbura, the capital. What we did is we gave bus money to various villages so women could come and have lunch and have this workshop and talk about microlending. So they came from many different villages. It wasn't just one village like the other two experiences. And I had an opportunity to interview probably 90% of the women with a translator. I had an amazing translator that could translate in Swahili and Kirundian. This one woman just struck me, and her essence was so beautiful. She was so shining and so bright, and I noticed when she came over that she also was on two crutches, and I noticed that she only had one leg. Now, the whole time, she never spoke to me about this.
Hmm.
She spoke to me about making baskets and her three children and that she was a widow. And every single woman I interviewed would get tears in their eyes about the genocide, but they never let the tears fall out of their eyes. It was quite amazing. And as she walked away on her crutches, I asked the translator what happened to her leg, and she said it was shot off in the genocide.
Hmm. And that was 10 years earlier?
10 years earlier. A little
she
more
than
10. She
was extremely radiant. And
she was incredibly radiant. She was incredibly radiant. She was really tapped into spirit. She really was.
The circumstances are not necessarily the defining force, is it?
Right. She was able to rise above it in herself.
Where did you stay in Burundi? What kind of accommodation?
We stayed in a place called the Safari Gate Hotel next to Lake Tanganyika. And it was just a moderate hotel, you know, kind of moderate circumstances, although I had a couple of wild nights. One night I went back to my room, and there was a foot-long lizard in my room.
Welcome
the guy
committee.
Downstairs, I said, you know, I love lizards, but I just don't think I can sleep with lizards. So he got the lizard out of my room. The next night I came and there was two lizards on the ceiling, about a foot long, each one of them. And as I got into bed, they fell down onto my bed. And I thought, you know, I just don't think I'm going to be able to do this. And the guys never got it out, so I dragged my mattress to my friend's Even though lizards are so symbolic of transformation and healing, I just wasn't sure I could sleep with them.
I can understand that. But your circumstances made comfortable. I mean, you had water and food and comfortable bed.
We had water and we had food. We had to be very careful of the food, even at the hotel.
Really?
We only really could eat things that were cooked. No salads, no raw vegetables, no raw food. Because they all use that water. And the water isn't filtered, and it's quite dirty. So we had to be careful. And
is that one of the projects that you want to get involved in?
One of the projects I want to do is looking at getting some little hand pumps or foot pumps that are closer to the villages and also with filters.
I think that's a very good idea. That's needed all over the world, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it's needed all over the world, and I'm very excited about working on that for you.
Now, in Mongolia, well, I'm excited for you. That's a really wonderful project, too. In Mongolia, is the water better? I mean, what is the food like? Is it quite as tasty?
Well, Mongolia is another interesting topic because, again, the water is a challenge. And they pretty much get the water out of the river.
Hmm.
So I always bring my own water pump and just pump the water out of the river because for the Mongolians, their stomach and intestines have acclimated, but there's, you know, animals, large animals, horses and yaks going through there and often run off from, you know, the excrement of the animals in the water. Doesn't seem to affect the Mongolians, but I got very ill last time for a couple of days. So we're very careful about that. The food's very different. The first year up at Lake Havasu with the reindeer people, all we had is yogurt and this hard cheese that they make and bread. Every once in a while, blueberries. Now, last year in Orhungai...
How healthy do the people look with a diet like that?
Well, when you first look at them, they look very healthy, and when you spend more time with them, you realize that they're really lacking some nutrients. Mm. They're really lacking vegetables and fruit.
They're not doing the smoothie and the green drinks and
all the things that we do all the time. No electricity, and have to walk and haul water as well, just as Africa does. And in fact, the first year, I was craving vegetables so much that we came across a little teeny store way out in the middle of nowhere with two little carrots, only like 4 inches apiece. And I said, I'll take those. And the two women with me said, it's going to take too much water to wash those carrots off. And I said, I'm giving up my water.
Wow.
Water ration for the night. I'm getting the carrots.
You're feeling really badly without your veggies?
I really missed it.
Yeah,
I really missed it a lot.
I have a hard time.
It's very different. In Orhungai, it's mostly, you're mostly eating meat.
Hmm.
And maybe a few little potatoes.
Wow.
But it's really hard on your system because you're not used to it. So I actually bring lots of protein bars with me.
Good for you. So, you know, it's interesting to me. This is perhaps a little bit of a digression for what we're talking about, but water is a global problem. It's a huge problem, isn't it?
It's a huge problem.
So are you thinking about water projects? I mean,
I've been thinking a lot about water projects. It seems like Africa, to me, is the one that I will tackle first in Burundi, just because of the heat and the distance and how dirty it is.
You talked about a water pump. What is that? What is that like? What is it? It pumps water out of a dirty river.
Well, what they do in Burundi is a group of men will dig a well as deep as they can dig it by hand, and then they'll put like a little metal pipe and then rig up something. Mostly the ones we saw were by hand, where a woman would have to, with one of her hands, pump it and bring the water up to maybe another little spout, and then she can fill her little bucket or can. They call them jerry cans, and they carry them on their head. And so I would love it, even if you did something that simple, but to put a filter on it. And I've seen many of them that also have foot pumps. And there's a fellow that wrote a book called Ending Global Poverty. His name's Stephen Smith. And he had run across someone that had a unique idea of building merry-go-rounds and using the resource of the energy of children to spin that merry-go-round and it fund the water up.
Isn't that great?
And perfect. He said that's a renewable resource, children's energy.
A little permaculture for you.
I loved it.
That is a brilliant idea. So it looks like you're going to be doing a number of different projects in these places, eh?
Yes. I'm going to continue on, and they're just going to keep building.
Do you work on any people there doing acupuncture or healing work?
No. Well, I did a lot of healing work in Mongolia, especially that woman that was dying. And we were able to shift her course for a little while. So I don't necessarily bring my needles because it's hard to get them through customs. And then it's hard to know what to do with them after I've used them.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have to go into, we have to have a sharp container, and those aren't very easily accessible in those countries. But I do a lot of human work.
That's wonderful. So you're trusted, too, right?
Mm-hmm.
People are... back to recommendations. What kind of things do you think people could think about? Many, many people that I speak to say they wish they could make a difference somehow. Can we talk a bit about that?
Well, you know, there's been a couple of unique things that have happened this summer. I was approached by a women's group, and this women's group has been together for about 20 years, and they said, you know, we want to leave a legacy to other women. And what could we do? And we brainstormed, and they were one of the ones that funded one of the bakeries.
Right.
What they decided to do is each woman, there was 10 of them, each woman put in $50, which made $500 to kickstart this bakery. And actually, we can do a bakery for usually around $300 even.
Hmm.
You know, helping each woman get some of the utensils that they need and the supplies. They decided they
wanted... Isn't that a small sum when you think about it?
It's a small sum. So some of the unique things that have occurred is groups of women wanting to leave legacies or groups of men. I just got an email from a man that wants to donate $1,000 towards the water system, a future water system.
Wonderful.
There's been many people
that's
that...
That's from Mongolia, or does he care with...
He wants it to go to Africa.
Okay.
And then there's many people that will donate $50 that will change a whole woman's life in Africa, in Burundi. There is a gal that I know from our clinic that just did the bike ride Seattle to Portland, and she called it Biking for Burundi. And so she actually got pledges of people that said, you know, I'll give you this much per mile for your 200-mile ride that
Excellent.
Goes towards Burundi.
Excellent.
So there's just so many different things. I've had young kids that sell cookies or Kool-Aid donate money.
That's wonderful.
So there's many different ways. Nothing is too small.
How do you keep track of it all?
Well, I have a bookkeeper.
This
and
is
then,
very wise.
This
is,
and I have a bookkeeper, and we work very closely together, and everything either goes in the Mongolia Fund or the Africa Fund. And then within those, some people specify, I want this to help for trees, or I want this to be the water project. So we're very conscientious about that. And then we keep people up to date by sending them newsletters, and we also send them the tax-deductible letter for their donations.
I'd like to be on your newsletter list.
Okay.
Yes. Now, who's Susan Bradbury? Where did you come from, and how did you get on this kind of track? And you don't have to tell your whole life story.
No. Well,
putting you on the spot here.
Well, I've always been very much attracted to working with people, always been very attracted to peace and harmonious situations. I am not a big conflict girl. And when this really accentuated, to keep the story not too long, was really that trip to South Korea. And that magical hike with these two women that I believe were shaman women. And we did many different rituals together. And that just opened the door for me. And now I'm starting to recognize, like, for instance, when I listen to Prosper from Burundi speak, and I get this feeling that I must act and do something. And the latest thing that's happened to me is with these three visits to the Middle East, every time I go to the Beatitudes, I get this feeling, this is home, this is home.
Wonderful.
Really deep in myself.
And where is the Beatitudes? Is that
and the Beatitudes is up from the Sea of Galilee.
Mm.
And so what has happened is I've just opened myself to show me where I could be of the most help. And what has presented itself is two women that are working with Ethiopian Jewish women. These women have traveled from Ethiopia, come to Israel because they're Jewish, and they're living in quite dire straits. And because of their culture, what I have been told through translation is that most of the women are to stay at home with the children and the family, and so they're not really to go outside of their culture to work. And because the Sound Essence Project is about sustaining cultures, changing lives, I'm very culture sensitive to different countries.
You're not a disruptor.
I don't want to disrupt things, and I don't want to bring my American perspective to their country, even though it's hard to completely get away from that. But I really want to be open to various people's cultures. And so I met with some of the Ethiopian Jewish women, and what they're doing is they're doing embroidery work. So my next project is helping them get sewing machines so that they can make purses or various
So they can do it at
home.
And
they can do it at home, so it won't really disrupt their culture and their way of life.
Nice.
But it will help uplift their whole family.
Great. Talking about families, what about your parents? Are they conscious, like just globally conscious?
My parents, I just saw this last weekend. They're in Redmond, and they're very globally conscious. We didn't do a lot of projects when I was growing up, and we didn't travel a lot, but we spoke about different cultures.
Both so they're interested
both in... Both my mother and father, and they've been very supportive of me.
But they're really proud of you.
Yeah, they've been very proud.
So your projects coming up are varied. So you have varied projects.
Varied projects. The one that's going to come up right away is August 9th, going to Mongolia.
Mm-hmm. And you're going for, what, 3 weeks?
3 weeks. I usually go for a month, but this time I think I'm going to reduce it to 3 weeks. A month's a long time.
And this time your husband's going.
And my husband's coming this time, which will be wonderful. He's not been to Mongolia, and I'm very excited to share this experience with him.
That's very interesting. Also, about the films that you're doing, storytelling films, how do people see those, or are they being shown yet?
They're not being shown yet. I really want to film the Eagle People this summer. And then we'll put all of the various areas of Mongolia together. And I don't have a direct plan. We may do some podcasts. We'll do some things on the internet. We'll maybe try to show the documentary to small little theaters around the world.
Now there's a whole on the internet. There's a whole website for a little film.
Right.
I don't mean YouTube. No,
there's
one called. Is it iFilm or something?
I think it's called iFilm.
Yeah, it's supposed to have some very wonderful...
Yeah. So we'll do those kind of things.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
So it doesn't have to be a project where it's being sold in the theaters and all that?
No, no.
And you'll make it available.
We'll make it available to the people, and we'll make 100% of it available to the Mongolian Natural Museum in Mongolia. And also...
What a wonderful service.
Oh, well, thank you.
Are you excited?
I'm excited. And then Western Washington University Library here in Bellingham has the largest Mongolian library in North America.
Oh, really?
And
why is that?
Professor Schwartz, he is a gentleman that has loved Mongolia his whole life. He started collecting books and donating them to Western, 25 years ago, and has continued... So that we're the largest resource of Mongolian literature and any type of book that you can think of to do with Mongolia, even Mongolian law, is here in Bellingham. So we even have students from Mongolia that come here to study.
It's a wonderful little town.
It's a wonderful little town, yeah. And so Professor Schwartz is a very big key to Mongolia.
Good.
In our area.
And it's just his passion.
It's his passion.
Isn't that a wonderful thing? So
we've
got great access here, and you're going to help add to it.
Hey? Yes.
Great. Let's see how our time is. We only have a few more minutes. The recommendation is that people can access you on www.soundessence.org.
Soundessenceproject.org.
Soundessenceproject.org.
And there's a way to contact us, which is contact@soundessenceproject.org, which you'll see on the website. And there also is availability to donate.
And I think that's wonderful. I might even donate. This is not a show just about getting you to donate. This is a show reminding, as we fire the grid, that some people are out there doing round-the-world amazing projects, and that you make it really, I can imagine being able to be of great help, even though I never know quite how. So I'm very excited about all that you say. So I think we have to sign off today, and I thank Susan Bradbury so much for spending this time with us. And also for everything you're doing. It's so inspiring. So thank you for coming.
Oh, thank you, Veronica. I thoroughly enjoyed every moment.
Me too. This is Veronica Entwistle saying thank you so much for tuning into Radiance by Design here on BBS Radio. And you can also contact me, Veronica, at Veronica Entwistle, ENTWISTLE.com. I'd love to get your feedback on this show. this particular program and the kinds of things we were talking about, and also your experience on Fire the Grid. Several of us were here last night, this morning, it felt like last night, and really found it a powerful, energy-surging time. Oh, my, and we were so exhilarated at 5:30 in the morning. Of course, I fell immediately asleep, but it was a very exhilarating ride, surfing the great downloads in the universe. Love to get your feedback on that. So email me, veronica@veronicaentwistle.com. Tune in on Thursday night at 8 o'clock, where I'm with Jackie Salviti. And we're working again on The Shadow, The Shadow Knows. And you can tune in for Jackie's next lesson on that. And I'm basically her sidekick, and I enjoy it very much. And we'll be back on Radiance by Design next Tuesday at 4 p.m. West Coast time. Many, many blessings to all of you. We're all participating in sending waves of love around the globe. I think we're done, are we? Is this the time? Or shall I just keep talking? So, the Fire of the Grid, do you think it's going to change the world? I guess what she said is it's going to take like 5 years before we're really going to see the difference. But I think we're going to feel it right away. What do you think, Susan?
I think we'll feel it right away. I think there'll be little ripples that the vibration will just open up for a new way of being.
My guide said, don't be surprised if you get little like dark pockets of backlash and so on that come up, too, because that's the... Just don't worry about it. It's just sort of what comes when you have a wake in the wave. So I thought, well, that was kind of good to hear as well. But I'm very excited about this is all going to be
too.
Different.
I'm very excited. And it felt so heartwarming to know that we were just so connected with humanity all around the world.
Me too. It makes me want to cry. So what we really need, isn't it?
Yeah.
We're part of an evolutionary generation. And I want to say to you, thanks for all your courage, because it's taken courage. I know you're being prompted by spirit and by your own journey, but it takes courage to do a lot of what you're doing. It's very inspiring.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you again. And we'll see you next week. Much love.
If I die, give my body to the sun. Please don't cry, this field of tears let me run. The echo sparsely tell me where to go, and I'm stuck between the rain and the snow. I didn't think dying would be so hard. I didn't think living would be so hard. Waking up in the turning tide was easier than living in your eyes, my love. And the paper I'm sorry if I ever pyramid.